You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is Bill Clark. Bill is the owner of the Literary Bookshop here in El Paso. He and his wife started that. It's been a couple years now, right, Bill?
16 months.
16 months.
Yeah.
And he is joining us here. We're going to talk about books, book collecting, perhaps a little bit about records, but in general, books, which is what we both love very much, and I'm sure that some of you listeners will have some questions about that as well. So, Bill, thank you so much for being with us here today. And first of all, as you mentioned, the shop has been open now for 16 months, but are you from El Paso originally?
No, Louis. I'm actually from Jackson, Tennessee originally. I grew up in a small town right in between Memphis and Nashville called Jackson, Tennessee. It's the home of Carl Perkins and W.S. Holland, who also was the drummer for Johnny Cash, and a good friend of mine by the name of Isaac Tigard, who also founded one of the museums of rock and roll, which is the Hard Rock Cafe, and he also was the founder of the House of Blues.
And so are you a collector of music albums as well as books?
Not so much collector. I did work in the music business, radio in the music industry in Los Angeles for 15 years before coming here to El Paso in 1993. Loved music. Two loves of my life, aside from my wife, are music and books.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, you are the owner of Literary Bookshop, along with your wife, Mary, and you've started this 16 months ago, as you mentioned. At what point did you decide that perhaps you wanted to open up a bookstore? Because I think when I first met you, of course, we met where else? At a library and a bookshop. And we were talking about the fact that you've been collecting books for many years.
Right. Well, Mariana and I both grew up with a real love of books, hers instilled by her mom, who helped found a library in a small town near the farm where she grew up in Arkansas. And I, for whatever reason, God gave me just a real love of books and love of the written word. And, you know, my fondest memories, as I said to someone last week, were the many afternoons that I spent at one of the beautiful Carnegie libraries that Carnegie built and endowed, if you will, in the small town that I grew up in. And so I've always loved books. We started collecting books, though, in the mid-'80s while living in Los Angeles.
Did your mom or dad instill interest in book for you, or how did you get interested in books?
I really don't know, because neither of my parents were well-educated people. They both grew up on farms in West Tennessee. My mom's parents were sharecroppers, and so neither of them were well-educated, but they certainly, when they saw that I loved books, they certainly encouraged it. And so I'm thankful too that I had some good librarians and other people who made books available to me.
So it sounds like your parents encouraged you to pursue the love of reading, unlike President Lincoln, who grew up also on a farm, and his father thought that it was a waste of time.
Oh, my parents never discouraged me from reading. In fact, there were a couple of occasions I can remember when I was in junior high, and my mother, who was quite religious, happened to sit down while doing housework one day, and she sat down, pulled out some of my Ian Fleming, James Bond books, and started reading through them. She was horrified by some of the scenes in Ian Fleming's James Bond books, but she didn't throw them away.
So is that what you remember the most about your love of books? Because a lot of people say, well, you know, when I was a kid, I loved the Hardy Boys. I loved Nancy Drew. I loved whatever. And yours was Ian Fleming, or was there another one?
Actually, I started earlier than that. I mean, I read all the Hardy Boy books. In fact, our church had a small library in it. And I guess another way that I can describe my mother's indulgence of my reading was that our church had this small library, and, you know, between Sunday school and the church service, I would always wander into the church library and pick up books, and I would take them into the church service, and I would read through church service. whether it was Hardy Boy or some biography of Kit Carson or whatever, and I was oftentimes reading adventure books and other things while the pastor was speaking, and it was one of those things that sort of went against my mom's values, but she cut me some slack on that, and so. But I started with Hardy Boys, and I read a wide array of things. But I found literature. I found the John Updikes of the world much earlier than, like when I was in high school, junior high and high school, than probably most people.
You mentioned, of course, the church you attended had a library, and we've heard stories, we've read and listened to some of these people who they learned how to read using the Bible because for many years that was like basically the only book they had in the house. Is that something that occurred around you and your friends?
Well, I mean, not so much with me. I don't really – I mean, I certainly grew up being exposed to the Bible a lot because my mom's faith particularly. But I can't say that the Bible was the source of my reading. I mean, I certainly read it as required of and that type thing, but it wasn't the foundation of how I learned to read.
A lot of times, the Bible was perhaps used also as a record family history. They would write everything in there, perhaps even throw receipts in there. And so, when people find an old religious book, whether it be whatever religion. They say, well, this is an old book, so it must be worth a lot of money. As a book collector, if you're looking for books, and I know there are a lot of genres out there, but what is something that you look for?
Well, in terms of type of book or the attributes of the book?
What makes it collectible?
Wow, that's a really complex question to answer. I will say that the first thing people really need to do is determine what they care about, what they love. I always say to people, collect what you love. Don't. It's not unlike art. When people say buy art you love, don't buy it for speculative investment purposes. Same thing with books. Find out what you really love and collect that. And if what you love is whether it's Bibles and Catholic missals, or whether it's a particular author, then find what you love and focus on that. But once you decide what you're going to collect, if you haven't collected in the past, then you really have to do your homework and become educated on it. Mariana and I certainly didn't have a strong foundation in collecting when we started, and we made some mistakes over the years, and we learned. Our education was costly in the early stages, but collect what you love and talk to someone who can help you develop a strategy and approach for how you build that collection.
So I guess depending on the genre too, it doesn't really matter. Date is not the most significant thing.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, quite frequently we have people come in and they'll say, oh, I have some old books. And you can tell by the way they say that they think old means valuable. And so, and that is certainly not the case in books. Old does not mean valuable. In fact, I can show you books that have come out just in the past two or three years that all of a sudden skyrocketed in value as compared to the cover price because of the fact that the book became a runaway bestseller or became a cult favorite of people. And so whereas the book may have sold for $30 with a cover price of $30, it may have very quickly become a $100 or $120 book. And then I can show you books from the 1800s that are basically worth a dollar. So age does not constitute value.
What about the type of paper they're printed on and also the binding?
Well, one of the most important things, if I can digress for just a second, Louis, is one of the most important things that I say to people is there's an old phrase in retail, which is location, location, location. And in collecting, it's condition, condition, condition. So that was one of the things that Mariana and I had to learn early on, because when we first started collecting, I would pick up books that I knew were of interest to me and that I knew I wanted in our collection, but I didn't hold out, if you will, for that better copy. And condition is probably the most important thing. It doesn't mean you're always going to get the condition that you'd like because of scarcity or whatever, but by all means focus on make sure that you pay attention to condition. So that's a key thing.
What about let me go back a little bit. We recently were aware of the PBS program, The Great American Read.
Right.
And they had many books featured there. And I believe the one that finally won out was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
And that may be a favorite for somebody. It might be your favorite. It might be my favorite. But we all have a favorite
sure.
book. And I remember talking with you in the past, and you mentioned that one of your all-time favorites is Weekend in Samara.
Yes, I love that book. I love that book, and it's a little slim book, but it's just a great book. And you mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird. That's another one of my all-time favorites as well. And in fact, probably 25 years ago, I had a dear friend and who I worked with, got to know in the music business in Los Angeles. And when his first daughter was born, he named her Scout for the little girl in To Kill a Mockingbird. And when she was born, Mariana and I gave her a gift upon her birth, and it was a signed copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. And that would have been around probably 1988. Of 89, and she and her partner recently got married, and I got a call, and she said, would you mind if I thought about selling To Kill a Mockingbird to pay for my honeymoon? And that book is, she ended up with a book that was considerably, worth considerably more than what we paid for it. She decided to hold on to the book rather than sell it. She financed her honeymoon in a different way.
What about editions? Because some people say, well, that's a second edition. Well, that's a first edition.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, that gets really, really tricky, and this is where a lot of people make mistakes. In fact, you'll find people who, you know, whether it's some dealers, whether it's estate sale people, you will find people who make mistakes. Sometimes it's unintentional. Other times, books sometimes, unfortunately, get passed off as first editions that are not first editions. So what you have is you have different editions of books. So when To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, first came out, that was the first edition. It may have gone it went through multiple printings. There was also a book club edition of that book. I guess a good example of a later edition of that book is that there was an anniversary edition of that book that was also printed. So there's different editions, and then within each edition there can be multiple printings. And then within each individual printing, there can sometimes also be what's called first state, second state. And so a first edition, first printing, means that they started up the press the first time they ever printed that book, and they ran X number of copies. If they stopped the press during the run, either on the jacket or the book, and they stopped the run to correct an error or to make some slight change, but they don't change the indicator in there for the first printing, then that would be what's known as a first state. So, for example, there is a typo in Charles Frazier's Cold Mountain. And that typo is, if you look at it in one edition, it says mad woman. In another state, it says man woman. Okay? They stopped the press. They made that correction. But it's still, if you go to the copyright page, it still indicates that it's a first printing. First edition, first printing. It's only if you know to look for the error that you'd know the difference between a first state and a second state. And if you're a serious collector, you want the first state.
And if you're a serious collector, you'll know these things, what to look out for?
Well, a serious collector may or may not. I say to people, it's funny, Louis, because some people will come in and they'll say, well, if it's a first edition, it would say so, right? Well, no, not really, because I can show you book clubs, which is a whole separate discussion almost. I can show you book club editions of books that say first edition in them. And it's only if you really know what you're doing that you would know that it's a book club rather than the first trade edition of the book, the trade edition being the most desirable. And so one way you can generally tell whether a book is a book club edition is that there's no price on the jacket. But now, many university presses also issue books without prices on the jacket. But if I have two copies of To Kill a Mockingbird laying on the table and they look similar, and one does not have a price on the inside flap of the jacket and the other one does, the one without the price is going to be the book club edition. That's a very general statement, but that's an example of the nuances of determining a first edition, first printing. Another good example, as I've said to people, is they go, well, but wouldn't the number line, there's a number line or a letter line that appears on the copyright page of many publishers. And so that letter line may read A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if the A is not there, and that line starts with a B, then that would indicate typically a second printing. Same with the number line. If it starts with 1 and goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, if the first number there is a 2, it more often than not means it's a second printing. Random House, on the other hand, their book says first edition, but the number line starts with a 2, and that's a nuance of Random House. So over the years, if you go back to old Scribner's books like Thomas Wolfe, Hemingway, some of the books that were published by Scribner's in the 20s and 30s, the copyright page will simply have a little tiny capital A on the copyright page. And so over the years, the publishers changed how they indicate a first edition. And so you have to be knowledgeable not only of how those indications, those issue points, as we call them, changed over the years, but also the differences between how different publishers indicate a first edition.
What about you mentioned jackets a little while ago, and everyone knows that over the years, sometimes the jacket of that book will change, and sometimes also depending on what country it's printed in, it will have a different cover. And sometimes people are interested in collecting perhaps the various jackets from different books.
Yeah, there are people who are considered completists. And that's a person who, for example, I'm a completist as it relates to Raymond Carver, a gentleman who once taught at UTEP very briefly and years ago. And Marianne and I got to know Raymond before he died, and he died rather young, in his late 40s. He was a phenomenal short story writer and poet, and we've collected everything of Raymond Carver, including his appearances in anthologies and other things. But a person who wants all the different editions of every single book or appearance that an author made, that person would be considered a completist. And now, as it relates, you mentioned European or foreign editions, those are oftentimes printed by a different press. And not only will the text in there be different, maybe have some differences in there, but also the binding may be different, the jacket will be different, and it may be actually a different imprint than the U.S. edition.
You mentioned book club earlier, and people who have been around know that, yes, there were book clubs, just kind of like the Columbia Record Company, and there are the Reader's Digest, condensed editions, and a lot of people, you'll find copies of those just about everywhere, the Reader's Digest condensed editions.
Yeah. The Reader's Digest condensed editions have no collectible value. Book club editions are not the most desirable editions of books. Serious collectors really want the the first trade edition of a book. There are some exceptions, though. Over the years, early book club editions, printings of books like To Kill a Mockingbird and certain really, really important classic books have appreciated in value. But generally speaking, the trade edition is what people seek from a collector's perspective.
When you and your wife, Marianne, started collecting in the mid-'80s, at that point, perhaps you had the dream of opening up your own shop then, but what were you looking for and what were you collecting back then?
Well, it's a funny story. We didn't really start with the idea of opening a bookstore, but I can remember distinctly, and one day when you're in the shop, I'll show you. I sometimes pull it out and show it to people. I can remember the day that I fell down the rabbit hole of collecting. I had left just got my hair cut, and I was walking down the street. It was after we had moved to the west side of L.A., and I passed a little bookstore by the name of Vagabond Books. It was owned by Craig and Patty Graham, who became good friends of ours. And I walked in, and it was the first time I'd been in there, and they had some books that were – they had a lot of used books, but in this one case, they had a glass top case, and that was filled with lots of books, and I looked in there, and I was always a big J.D. Salinger fan, and I loved – one of my favorite books of his was Nine Stories, and I loved his stories. Most people know him for Catcher in the Rye, which I think is – frankly, I think his best – probably his best book is Franny and Zooey, but I loved Nine Stories, and I walked in, and they had two little nondescript – very, very plain-looking little paperbacks in there. And it was the uncollected stories of J.D. Salinger, in Volume 1 and Volume 2. Very plain wraps, little slim volumes. And if you're familiar with the music business, you've probably heard a phrase, bootlegs. And these are unauthorized music recordings, right, of concerts or whatever, or studio sessions that weren't, you know, that someone – stole and released them. And what someone had done was they had gone out, because Nine Stories was the only book of Salinger's short stories, yet he wrote a lot of short stories that were published in periodicals in different places. So what some individual did was they went and found all of his appearances in print of his short stories, and they put those together and published these little collections of J.D. Salinger's short stories. And I had to have it. And so I bought those two volumes. And after that, I just sort of fell down the rabbit hole of collecting.
As far as collecting after that, I know that you and your wife have different interests. And when my daughter and I visited with you almost a couple years this Christmas, we talked a little bit about that. But as a bookstore owner, what do you find out as far as, should I buy this book? Should I get this book? How is it that you know what your readers want, what your customers want? Because as you and I have discussed also before, the big ones like Barnes & Noble, Amazon, mm-hmm. they're kind of like, you know, they're really no competition for the small companies like yourself. But at the same time, you're very loyal to local authors and regional authors as well, which some of the big stores are not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're doing with the bookstore actually is contradicts a lot of how I spent my business career. And I spent most of my career in business, a large part of it in marketing. And in marketing is basically give the people – you find out what people want and you give them that. And in curating a small bookshop like this it's a balance between offering people things that you believe that the market wants and at the same time creating a shop that reflects your own level of your own interest and your own taste, and maybe through that introducing people to things that they may not otherwise be aware of. And so there's a fine balance in there. And so, for example, I don't have a great interest in history personally. Mariana's a big mystery and suspense person. There's only two or three mystery and suspense writers that I really love, and I use those books more for diversion. But we have a very strong Southwest section, which covers everything from El Paso and Texas and Mexico and New Mexico and Southwest in general, because there's considerable interest here in that, and that may include books by the Leon Metzes of the world. The books, Tom Lee's books, and we just finished a series of three events this month in conjunction with the Tom Lee Institute, where we featured books by local authors. And so, yes, you want to have things in the shop that you know are of interest to people, and at the same time, we do. For example, we've brought in new books from some small presses. Books that you won't readily find at Barnes & Noble that are world literature in translation. And so you take Deep Vellum Press and Dallas, which is a literary arts nonprofit press, and Two Lines, which is a similar nonprofit press in San Francisco. And what those two small presses have done is they've gone around the world and they found the great writers, either emerging voices or established writers, whose works haven't really been exposed to the English language reader, and they've brought those books to the U.S. and they've translated them into English and bound them really in beautiful little soft cover bindings, and we'll make those books available because we're not going to compete with Barnes & Noble on the bestsellers. Or with Costco or Sam's. We're going to focus on books that people will not readily find elsewhere.
The holidays are just around the corner, and sometimes, you know, people will choose a book to give to someone. And I'm not sure if we share the same feeling, but when I find a good book and I really like it, I want to share it with somebody else. And perhaps, you know, I'll buy several copies because I give them away. And so people who come into your store, is there anything in particular that they should be on the lookout for, or I guess they should tell you pretty much a little bit about that other person?
Yeah. In fact, that's a really good point, Louis, because we do have people coming in for gifts. And the first thing we ask, if they don't really have a specific thing in mind. Sometimes people will come in, they're looking for something very specific. They know what the person's interest is. Oftentimes they come in and they say, I'm looking for a gift. And that's where the question ends. And so then we try to probe and find out, you know, whether it's the, you know, what are the interests of the recipient, where do they live, what do they do when they're not at work, are there any readers that or any authors that the person knows that person loves. So yeah, it's really trying to be thoughtful about that, and there have been instances when we've said, hey, you know what, we're just not quite sure how to best help you with this. Can you get us a little bit more information, because we want to pick out the right thing?
Is there a web page that people can go to find out a little bit more about book collecting and also your shop?
Well, they can certainly go to our Facebook page right now to find out about the various events we're doing. We have a flurry of events going on right now and through the end of the year, including with local authors. And so they can follow our Facebook page to find out about new arrivals and about special events, that type thing. And we're rebuilding our website at the moment.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Louis.
We've been visiting with Bill Clark. He and his wife, Mary Ann, own the Literary Bookshop, and it's here in West El Paso. And if you have additional information or questions that you want to inquire about, you can go to Bill and Mary Ann's Facebook page, and that's the Literary Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sines.